I mean, when you come from journalism, like, you're trained in a seduction of writing. Like, you never take for granted that you have the reader. You can't just treat this like it's good for people. You're trained to think they're just going to turn to the article next to it. Like, grab them, hold them, you know?
Welcome back to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. It has been a little while since I've said those words. I know the podcast has been absent for over a year. The reason for that is that I've been writing a book, and I'm going to tell you a bit more about that at the end of the episode. Meanwhile, the voice that you heard at the top was that of the journalist, author, and activist Naomi Klein. Naomi is best known for her fierce, famous, best-selling books like 1999's No Logo, which laid out her arguments about the damage caused by corporations, or 2007's The Shock Doctrine, in which she coined the term disaster capitalism, or 2014's This Changes Everything, which examined the relationship between climate change and capitalism. Last year, she published Doppelganger. It starts with her irritation at being mixed up with the far-right pundit Naomi Wolf, and it goes on to explore the rise of conspiracy theorists and polarised politics. These are pretty weighty subjects, and I know that some people come to this podcast mainly for the novelists, but I really hope you'll keep listening because the conversation that we have in this episode is about the writing process. I was struck by how funny Naomi is and how relatable some of her writing challenges are, like trying and failing to wake up even earlier than her child so that she can get some work done. Naomi talks about her writing calendar and how she organises all of the different tasks of research and reading that are required in order to write these kinds of books. There are surprises too. I wouldn't have expected that after 2 decades of being a massively best-selling author, she would have taken on a writing tutor, but that's exactly what she did during the pandemic. And she talks about how in Doppelganger, she tried to shift her writing voice to something that's closer to the way she speaks. We also talk towards the end of the interview about finding hope, or at least some sense of calm, through writing. And I found that part really helpful, particularly as her work deals with some pretty scary global issues. Before we get started, I'm delighted to say that this season of In Writing is sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the Literary and Talent Agency. Since launching in 2011, over 240 of their students have gone on to get major book deals, including critically acclaimed authors Julia Armfield, Bonnie Garmus, and Benji Waterhouse. Curtis Brown Creative offers a wide range of writing courses, online or in London, designed to help you no matter what your current skill level is. If you're interested in bringing your true stories to the page, join their 6-week online writing a memoir course with exclusive teaching videos, resources, and writing tasks from best-selling author Kathy Rensenbrink. Curtis Brown Creative have provided an exclusive discount for In Writing listeners. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of writing a memoir or any other 6-week online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. Now, back to Naomi. We spoke in June at her publisher's office in London, but I started, of course, by asking her to describe the room where she writes, back home on the west coast of Canada.
I sort of feel a bit bad about it. I think I live in the most beautiful place in the world, which... just before I describe it, I will just say it's very inconvenient. I'm 3 hours from the closest city, and I teach at a university, and I have to take a ferry boat to get to the city. So there's lots of inconveniences about living where I live, and we moved there during the pandemic. But there's also wonderful things about it. So the room looks out on the Salish Sea, which is the body of water between the mainland of British Columbia and Vancouver Island. So it's pretty calm, except during storms. There's lots of cedar and Douglas fir trees around. And the part of the coast where we are is quiet enough that there's just a lot of wildlife. We see a lot of eagles. And it's where I've been writing since 2005. So I wrote after No Logo came out, and I was very lucky with the reception to that book. I used the money from No Logo to buy this. I called it the room with a view. No, sorry, the view with a room. I always get that wrong. The view with the room. And so I wrote the shock doctrine there, and I wrote much of This Changes Everything and a lot of Doppelganger. So often I'll sort of cover the walls with cue cards if I feel like I need it, if I feel like I'm getting lost. I learned that from doing documentary film.
So what kind of things would the cue cards have on them? Would it be kind of chapter headings or...
More than just chapters, but like maybe each chapter would have three or four, so sub themes within chapters. I have found it helps me to think structurally and also remember where I am in the arc of an argument. With Doppelganger, I sort of wrote my way into it. I didn't have a full outline when I began writing, and I didn't. But for my other books, I've had a full chapter outline, and I just like to be able to see it as I'm writing, as opposed to just have a Word document that lays it all out. It helps me to look at it, and I do move chapters around a little bit. So that's the nice thing about having actual physical cue cards.
Is it a dedicated room for your office?
Well, no? Now it is, but when I was writing Doppelganger, I didn't have a dedicated room. It was our bedroom, which had a desk, and it's actually more open than I would have liked. Now that I have kids, so I actually had to leave home to write big parts of Doppelganger. I went away three times while I was writing to even more isolated places. I rented an Airbnb twice near my house, but just to actually have a physical space where I could work through the evenings and not parent at all. So my partner was, Avi, was kind enough to support me disappearing three times. Another time I disappeared was to my friend V's house in the Hudson Valley of New York State.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And she has a little guest house. And so that was kind of dreamy because I had the isolation to work all day, but then in the evenings I could go have dinner or watch a movie with V, and she lives there with another mutual friend, Celeste. So the best of the sort of isolation plus a little bit of community and friendship, because I do find being completely alone, I go a little bit mad. So So I was a bit itinerant on this book, to be honest, because I didn't have enough of a enclosed space. So since Doppelganger was finished, I've built a little office outside of the house now.
Okay. So it's a kind of a shed, outdoor building. And then do you have a view over the water from your desk?
No, but I have some nice view of trees.
Okay. Very nice. Peaceful.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to come back to talking about the cue cards, because I want to ask you later about structure. And it sounds like that is quite important to have the visual cue for that. But are you writing at the moment?
It's a complicated question for me right now. It's been a very difficult and emotional year. I published Doppelganger almost exactly 1 month before October 7th. A big part of the book deals with Israel and Palestine and Judaism, and actually the book ends with a passage in Gaza. And so the last stop of my book tour was October 4th. And so I came home, and ever since then, I've been really involved in movements calling for a ceasefire and different debates about responses to October 7th, and trying to make sense of the psychology of how it could be that a state that was founded in part as a response to a genocide could be committing more crimes that are being investigated as a genocide by the International Court of Justice. Whether you believe it to be a genocide or not, there's a plausible case for it. And to me, as a Jewish person and somebody who's thought a lot around how trauma kind of moves around the globe and how people who have been victims can become victimizers, and that being a kind of running theme of that has perplexed me and drawn me to my whole writing life. I have been writing a lot but I have not been publishing a lot since, and it's not clear to me what I'm going to do with the writing. I have filled many, many notebooks. I have read a lot. I have stacks and stacks of books about trying to understand memory, German memory culture, collective trauma. I'm reading sort of psychotherapy. Like I'm reading beyond my comfort zone in a way, because I don't feel like I even have the analytic tools to understand the historical moment we're in, which I think transcends politics and is deeply psychological. And so I don't know. I'm not planning a book exactly. I'm actually designing a course to teach about some of these themes, and that will probably be the first stage of figuring out if I want to write something long form.
But that sounds, I mean, it sounds like a very difficult time emotionally and quite an exhausting time, but it also sounds like quite a fertile time for new ideas, and being pushed into reading beyond what you would usually pick up is always interesting, I think, for forming new trains of thought. And
yeah,
you know, it's like you're percolating something that maybe in a few years will...
I think so. I mean, I have not had the headspace or uninterrupted time to just kind of think. So, and it's not so much because of demands on me and more the demands that I sort of place on myself. It feels like a time to be engaged in the world and not a time to sort of hide away and disengage. So I haven't had this space that I need to follow the thoughts, to follow the ideas. But I this summer I've just cleared my schedule of any kind of public events, because I often think that in my experience, conversation is very productive for developing ideas. I always remember that I got the idea for my first book, No Logo, during an interview. I'm not someone who's afraid to think in public. I'm not somebody who sticks to their talking points and just repeats themselves in every interview. I really do try to be present and have a conversation, because I believe that conversation is productive, and that we bounce off of each other's intellects and presence. But at a certain point, you do have to sort of stop outputting if you're going to do something new. So I feel like I really do need to do that.
Going back to the practical for a moment, when you are writing, when you're working on a book, what's your kind of routine with that? Are you spending particular hours at the desk? Are you thinking in terms of clocking up word count, or is it not?
Yeah, I've never been one of these very disciplined writers like Margaret Atwood, who writes like 500 words a day no matter what. We've all heard about those people. I tend to get really consumed by a project, and then I write all the time, like from morning till night if I possibly can. Now that I have a university job and I'm not able to do that as easily, like what I'll do is I'll clear like a 3-week period or a 2-week period. And like I was saying, I, you know, created these little mini escapes from family to be able to, staying with friends or whatever it is to be. And I have it when I'm consumed by a project, I have a capacity to work continuously. It's not healthy, but I will. There's a wonderful luxury for me to be able to write first thing in the morning, and it's not one I have at home just because of parenting and making lunch and things like that. That's the thing I think I probably struggle with most on the parenting front, is the loss of morning brain. And I'm not disciplined enough. I have parent friends who wake up unspeakably early. Like my child has always been a really early riser, so it's very hard to rise earlier. And I would always feel like no matter how early I would wake up, like setting the alarm to be an hour ahead of him, he would always just know and just be there waiting for me. Hello. So it's about using that morning brain. And then like when I was writing this book, I remember on one of my little writing getaways, which was really just up the road, a neighbor was kind enough to let me use their place. And my husband, Avi, is just so great. I was having a lot of back pain. So we brought up a whole ergonomic setup. You know, I brought my desk chair and I think we even brought a desk because it didn't have a proper desk. And I do have back pain. So, it has, I can't be in a bad ergonomic setup for if I'm going to actually sprint. So yeah, first thing with coffee, writing, and then going for walks, with podcast, listening to something related to the book. I mean, in this book, I talk about how unhealthy my habits are around like doing yoga and listening to, you know, far right podcasts, yeah. conspiracy theories. And then the nice thing about this book, but this was true even of The Shock Doctrine, is I make sure to have a bunch of film that relates to it. So when my, you know, I'll tend to read in the evenings and write during the day. This is in my dream. This is not my, I'm not able to do this in a normal week, but if I'm in writing mode and I can really give myself over to it, I'm writing when my brain is freshest and then reading. And then when it really gives up, then I'll watch documentary films or feature films that relate to the theme. And the thing about doppelgangers is there's so many great films. There's so many things that you could even claim was research. Like, I mean, I watched the Parent Trap remake with Lindsay Lohan. Was like, I'm doing research right now.
Important part of the book, yeah.
But when I was writing, when I'm doing very research heavy nonfiction, what I try to do, I did this with The Shock Doctrine more diligently. And I do have to have like a big asterisk. Like there's like pre-parent me. I mean, I had my son when I was 42 years old. So I had written several books before becoming a parent. And then there's post-parent me, which are really different writing practices. But for The Shock Doctrine, one of the things I struggle with is that every theme that I've ever written on, I could research forever. And I actually enjoy research more than writing. I mean, there are moments of writing that are true joy, but it's more frequent that I'm having elation in a moment of research, of a moment of sort of discovery of aha and sort of, you know, writing in my notebook and things like that. So one of the things I struggle with is feeling like there's always something else I should be doing than the thing I'm doing. If I'm writing, I should be researching. If I'm researching, I should be writing. So I block out reading times and writing times. So there's a sharper distinction. So once I have my outline, I make a calendar that blocks out when I'm going to write each chapter. But within that chapter, I block out when I'm going to be reading and also reporting. But the reporting I do before, like anything that involves travel or, you know, reporting on the ground, that's before the writing process. So assuming I've done all of that kind of reporting work, I'm still reading, and I block the internet when I'm writing, using all the devices and things like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's been very important to me to have weeks where it just says on my schedule that I'm supposed to be reading, or else I feel bad that I'm not writing.
Right.
But then it's also important that I know that I do have to stop.
Yeah.
The reading part and do the writing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Each has their time.
Yeah. And it's also different body positions, right? Because, yeah, you need that variety.
So are you sort of lying down reading and then
or in like
at
a reading chair or whatever, moving around. Yeah. The nice thing about reading is you can do it in lots of different positions, but I find with writing, I'm just locked into one position.
Yeah. You said a few years ago that it takes you about 5 years to write a book. Do you think that's still about on track?
It really depends on the book. I mean, this book is not like other books I've written in that it really, it's more memoir. It weaves together research from previous books and new research. But I didn't take 5 years to write this book. I took two. First of all, I thought I was writing a long essay. I didn't think I was writing a book. And then it kept sort of growing. And then...
It's a very long essay.
It is more like a long essay, right? And this book grew out of a feeling of speechlessness, of not knowing if I could write the kind of books that I have written in the past, which have had a very sort of declarative thesis and fact, a thesis that is defended throughout the book and restated and an argument that builds, whereas this is much more of a winding road, exploring different kinds of doubles. And it does have a cumulative impact and it does go somewhere, but it is much less direct. And it is a route that I sort of found in the writing. So unlike all my other books before, including my first one, with no logo, I had an outline. I had a sample, an introduction, a sample chapter. It was probably like a 50-page outline all told with sample chapter. And I had a contract and a deadline, and I needed to execute that plan, right? Whereas with Doppelganger, I didn't tell anybody I was writing this book. I didn't have an agent. First of all, I was between agents, and I didn't tell my editor who I've worked with since Snow Logo in Canada, and I knew I was going to be looking for another publisher in the U.S. So I had written 10 chapters before I had an agent, before anyone knew about this book. So I really wanted it to be, I discovered it in writing it. I didn't write it with a fear that I had to deliver it because I said I would. It was an entirely self-driven project. It had nothing to do with anybody wanting anything from me. Yeah. In fact, quite the opposite, as I say at the beginning of the book, no one asked me to, several people cautioned me against it. there's nothing I can really say about Doppelganger that applies to other books that I've written or probably will write again.
But there is, in every book, I guess there is a moment where you start to think it is a book, and it sounds as though you are somebody who is out in the world meeting people, reading, watching, having interesting conversations, thinking, and then gradually it sounds as though something that is concerning you and that you're thinking about a lot and that's going around in your head becomes something that is book.
I usually work my ideas out in journalism. So, No Logo was, I had a newspaper column. I edited a magazine. I was exploring a bunch of the issues that fell on under the umbrella of an emergent anti-corporate politics that was not yet sort of understood as a politic when I was writing the book. But I was covering Reclaim the Streets. I was covering anti-sweatshop activism. I was covering the early attempts to unionize service sector chains. This is the 90s. And so I took chunks out of that book. Well, I didn't know it was a book. I mean, I did it as magazine features. I did it as newspaper columns. And like I said, I was having a conversation with a journalist where I had been writing a lot about the casualization of work that my generation was facing. And I had also been writing about sort of cutting edge new marketing theories that were co-opting youth culture. I mean, I was in my 20s. I wasn't like the youth beat. I was like a token youth columnist. and I really was. And I had never seen these kind of big trends as connected until I was talking to this journalist, and I was saying, these companies, they don't see themselves as producers anymore, and that's why they don't spend their money producing. They spend their money on marketing. And then I was sort of a click moment where I realized that there was a connection between this disinvestment from the world of work and production and this hyper investment in the world of branding and lifestyle marketing. And so that was sort of an idea that didn't that had the potential to weave together all this other research that I'd been doing and plus more that I wanted to do. And so that's when the idea for No Logo was kind of born. I think with the shock doctrine, I had covered the invasion of Iraq for Harper's Magazine. I had written about the attempts to privatize the Iraqi economy sort of immediately after the US-UK invasion. Then I covered some attempts to do something very similar after natural disasters, the Asian tsunami and Hurricane Katrina. I'd written a big magazine article called The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And so it was like, at a certain point, you start to see like a pattern that is beyond, an individual article. I think that's the case for a lot of nonfiction books. But Doppelganger was different. I did not have a theme I wanted to write about. What I wanted to do was write in another way. It came out of a desire to not do that kind of linear and conventional nonfiction. And I wasn't able to do the kind of reportorial work that I was used to doing because I was in lockdown. I was isolated in my home like so many of the rest of us. And I was feeling very politically discouraged. And I decided, well, if I can't go anywhere, maybe I can do something I've always wanted to do, which is take a writing course. And I had heard that some of the writing schools like Iowa were doing online courses like everybody else. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, this is the first time in my life where I haven't been running around all over the place. I could take a writing course. I could take a creative nonfiction course. And I ended up not doing that, but working with a teacher privately for a few months. Her name's Harriet Clark. She's a wonderful editor at the Paris Review now, and has taught creative nonfiction and fiction in different contexts. And she took me on, and we started writing just exercises, and she gave me new interesting things to read. And I think that it was Harriet's writing assignments that got me reading things just because they were interesting ways of organizing information, not because they were things that were about a subject that I wanted to know about, right? You know, whether it was like Joan Didion, you know, talking about writing in her notebook, or Catherine Schultz on being lost, or like, you know, these sort of titans of literary nonfiction. And that was what made me think, oh, this doppelganger thing is really, it's a productive tool to write about a bunch of things that are on my mind, but to do it more lightly and less sort of exhaustively as I usually do. Like, I'm a completist on the themes that I write about, but in Doppelganger, I touch more lightly on these different themes.
Yeah, even though you put thousands of hours into listening to far-right podcasts and all of that stuff, yeah. I think something that always strikes me in your writing is that your books are quite long, they're dense with information, they're very deeply researched, and they're making complex arguments and expressing complicated, nuanced thoughts. But they're very readable. And I know as a writer, it's really difficult to express complicated things in clear language. And I think you're so good at that. Does that come easily to you, or do you really craft those sentences to make sure that you're getting the point through as simply as you can?
Well, I think because I come from journalism, I always am thinking about how can I say this in the sort of, I mean, when you come from journalism, like, you're trained in a kind of seduction of writing. Like, you never take for granted that you have the reader. You can't just treat this like it's good for people. You're constantly you're trained to think they're just going to turn to the article next to it, like, totally, grab them, yeah. Hold them, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that's a certain kind of writing. And I don't think it's the kind of, like, in this case, I, you know, this book is written quite differently from books that have just a ton of stats in them, a ton of you know, complex referencing and sourcing, right? I mean, I do draw on a lot of doppelganger literature, but I'm not using a kind of academic citation style. I'm citing them much more sort of lightly and conversationally. My goal with Doppelganger was to write in my truest voice as I can, because I had felt that my voice was getting away from me. I mean, when I first wrote No Logo, I was an unknown Canadian writer. That book is more conversational. It's a little funnier. You know, it's like I described it as a mall rat memoir meets investigative journalism, right? And so I was very conscious when I wrote that book that I wanted to write a critique of branding culture from the perspective of somebody who really understands the appeal, not from the perspective of somebody outside of the culture shaking their finger at it. Like, I'm not Neil Postman. I'm not going like, what are the kids doing these days? I'm, yeah, like, I get it. I want it. I don't like wanting it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's part of the kind of seduction of that I think of a lot of first person writing is, like, you know, we draw each other in by trying to create some kind of bonds of identity with the reader. Like, you're like this, I'm like this. Don't we know what this is like, right? And I think that the books that I wrote between No Logo and Doppelganger, Shock Doctrine, This Changes Everything, are more of a sort of voice of authority, right, kind of voice. It's less my actual voice that I have with people when I'm talking. And I'm not sort of throwing those books under the bus. I think there's a place for that kind of writing, and I think I may well do it again. But that wasn't my goal for this book. I really wanted to, I wanted to try to refine my actual voice on the page.
Yeah.
And there was a moment when I did a collection of essays called On Fire, and I wrote a new introduction, a pretty long introduction. So it was around 20,000 words, and it's very fact heavy. It kind of brings stuff up to date on the climate crisis. And I did the audiobook for that. I did the audio read just for the introduction, not the rest of the book. And it was so hard to read it. It took me so many takes. It was so frustrating. Like, and I realized that it was because I was not writing the way I talk, and I was kind of tying myself in knots, doing all these like complicated references and things like that, and all these statistics, which are so hard to read. And so I think the biggest change with Doppelganger is I knew that I was going to read the audiobook. I promised myself I would read the audiobook for the first time, the whole thing. And so when I was writing, I often read it out loud.
Yeah. And that wasn't a regular part of your process before that.
No. It was much more about, I mean, frankly, like just getting it right than it was about readability. And, you know, especially a book like This Changes Everything, which, I mean, I don't know how many pages of endnotes that book has, but, you know, partly it's like, you know, a lot of these books it takes me 5 years to write them because it's practically like getting a PhD in a new topic. You know, I had never written about the climate crisis before, and I was, you know, imbibing a huge amount of academic material. And then there's a way in which that kind of writing sort of infects you as a writer, right? Then you have to try to free yourself from it, because if you're going to write in a way that popularizes it, you have to be careful that, you know, you're not writing a really turgid prose. But at the same time, you have to prove that you know your stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And so it tends not to be all that, I don't want to throw those books under the bus, like I said.
No, great books.
That's actually something Harriet said to me, my writing teacher, that when I talk about what is different about this book, I have to not throw my other books under the bus. So I'm like, Harry, okay, Harry, I'm not throwing it under the bus, but I do, it really is, I never ask myself, how could I read this?
Is it important to you that you're not just talking to other people who are also experts in this field, but that you're talking to people who might not know a lot of this stuff and might not have thought about it?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I try to remember the me that was before I read all of it, you know, and that's sort of who I'm explaining it to. And this is also why I kind of over-research, is that I think you need to get a level of confidence to be able to simplify, to be able to popularize. I think you're most likely to imitate when you're not confident in your grasp of the material.
Yeah.
So you've got to kind of mess around a bit. You have, like, in order to play with form, you have to really marinate the material. And those were very heavy editing processes as well. Like the difference, I mean, one of the big differences with Doppelganger is that the book didn't change all that much in the editing. Like what I handed in was very close to what was published.
Yeah.
Changed some. If you're listening, Alex, you did definitely help me a lot, especially on the Israel-Palestine stuff. But it was, I had already kind of worked it a lot by the time it got in there. Whereas with other books, it was sort of like I handed in a rougher first draft, and then the editing was, there was a bit of excavation involved. Yeah.
I've written my first book, which is coming out later this year, and it's only 280 pages, and the material is a lot simpler than what you're working with. But I realized that in writing a book, you have to hold these two very different perspectives on the work at the same time, one of which is sort of close up. You have to be really looking at every paragraph and every sentence, and at the same time you have to be able to look at the book in total from a kind of distance and remember how things fit in together and remember how what you're working on today is connected to what's happening in chapter 8 or whatever. And you know, I found that a real intellectual stretch to for
well,
me.
Well, cue cards help.
Well, that's what I was thinking of when you were talking about the cue cards. And I just, with a book like Doppelganger, where you, it is really wide ranging. You cover a lot of stuff that, you know, if you had told me the themes before I'd read the book, I would have been like, I don't see how these are going to fit together, but okay. But they do. I mean, how do you keep a whole project like that in your head? Is it, are the cue cards a part of that?
Honestly, I'll tell you, I really feel like almost all of my writing is in order not to forget it, right? Something. So I keep it in my head by writing it. But yeah, the cue cards definitely help. And yeah, I have different little tricks. I mean, I usually have a notes. I have a notes file for every chapter where I just kind of put, you know, any kind of thoughts, notes after reading a book. I also have terrible handwriting. It's really, really messy. So, but I do write longhand a lot. And then I have to transcribe it while I can still read my handwriting. That's very important. I'm always learning how to do this. But I mean, the other thing that I'm struck by is that I have been writing books for a long time. I've been writing books for my first book came out a quarter of a century ago. And I've learned from my editor. So I think, you know, when you're working with a young writer as an editor, you're their teacher in a lot of ways. I think I remember things that I learned from really good magazine editors about creating dialogue and character and, you know, a sense. I learned a lot from my writing teacher, Harriet, about sort of creating suspense at the end of chapters, which was very different than the kind of nonfiction writing that I'd been doing before, where it was like every chapter sort of nailed the argument, you know?
Right.
And then you move on to the next chapter.
Sort of almost standalone.
Right. But like Louise Dennis, who was my first editor, she was at Knopf Canada. There were two things that I learned from her that really stayed with me. One was just that it can't just feel like the next chapter can't just feel like, oh, and here's another thing. It has to feel like it's built. You're building. You're going somewhere. There's a cumulative journey that you're on. And I think a lot of nonfiction book is just like, and here's another one and another one. And that's where it's sort of like you feel like you could leave it at any point. Right. But still, in books like The Shock Doctrine and This Changes Everything, those chapters do kind of stand on their own in the same way of sort of a magazine article. The other thing I learned from Louise was that, you know, I had developed a kind of a sassy voice as a young pop culture columnist for a newspaper. And I was sort of a little bit sarcastic, making a lot of jokes. And I remember her writing in the margin, like, you know, Naomi, this is funny, but remember that the reader is aware that they have to spend a fearsome 400 pages with you.
Well, so don't be too much too quickly.
Don't
basically.
Be too much. Like what might be fun for knowing you're reading an 800 word opinion column is exhausting if you're holding a 400 page book. Like you don't want to spend that much time with that sort of funny, sassy,
tone.
Bratty.
That's so interesting.
You know, but it really is different. And once she said that, well, first of all, I was deeply offended. I'm like, of course you want to spend that much time with me. But I, it's just one of those sentences that has just echoed in my brain, like fearsome 400 pages, fearsome 400. No. And, yeah. And so just, you have to make sure you're good enough company, right? Whatever you're doing, you have to make sure it's a very different ask to write a book than it is to write an article in terms of what you're asking of a reader and the kind of company that you want to be. But then the thing that I really learned that was different with Doppelganger, which was so counterintuitive for me as an overprover, say you're going to do it, say that you did it, you know, thesis-based writer all these years, was these little teasers that Harriet would encourage me to like put at the end of the chapters, of just like these notes of uncertainty that would make a reader want to read on. And it's just it's a whole other toolkit that this kind of writing.
It's funny because we know that writers do this and TV writers do it. And, you know, and we know that we're being manipulated, but it's irresistible. Like everybody loves a cliffhanger. Do you see what you do as creative?
I think so, because I've always, you know, even the books that I'm calling linear are always exercises in pattern recognition. I'm just hesitating because this is going to sound like a self-aggrandizing anecdote, but it's kind of a weird anecdote, which is I met William Gibson, the science fiction writer, once I interviewed him for a literary festival, and he had just written a book called Pattern Recognition, and it was about this cool hunter who went around, you know, the globe, Japan, wherever, like cool hunting the latest youth trends. But she had an allergy to logos, and she would like physically be repulsed by them, and she would sand down the logos on the buttons of her jeans and things. And he told me that he was inspired to create this character from not reading No Logo, but just the idea of the book, which he's like, I'd never read, but he said, it's pattern recognition. And that's what, you know, that's, and it helped me sort of see what I do as pattern recognition, which I think it was true of the shock doctrine as well. Definitely true of doppelganger. So there's a creativity in that you're not, it's not topic. It's not a definable topic until you define it.
Yeah. You're deciding which story you want to tell. Ultimately, I'm not saying you're inventing the story, but you are selecting the story in a way and shaping it into
not just the story, but even the subject area, right? Like something like disaster capitalism, like that would be, it's like the whole point of doing it is that it gives people a lens to understand seemingly disconnected events. It allows, like, I always see my writing as helping people read the newspaper better.
Yeah.
Like in the sense that they'll have a tool to be able to sort this deluge of information.
Yeah.
In a way that makes sense. And that, you know, that's always, you know, that's, there's risks to, associated with that. It also, and this is part of what I work with in doppelgangers, like, have I encouraged people to see the world through a conspiracy theory of like, this is what elites are always plotting against us? You can go too far. You can see it when it's not there, but it's often there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this has been one of the, you know, themes of my writing life is people coming to me and telling me, this is the shock doctrine. Look what's happening here and there. Things that I hadn't noticed, using a tool that I have given them to give something back to me. You know, I would get lots of article ideas that way. Readers, you know, I'll often not know that there's an example of the shock doctrine going on until somebody in Hawaii reaches out to me and go, they're doing it in Maui after the wildfires. Like, will you write about it? Yeah. But that's been, you know, that's been a really nice thing about doppelganger is that, you know, I do see it as a kind of attempt to make a map of the post pandemic world, or, you know, we know the pandemic is still around, but to take seriously the idea that our world has changed in ways that we don't yet understand. And this is Arundhati's frame of the pandemic as a portal, right? That we're going somewhere, that we have choices to make about what we want to bring with us through the portal. But this is such a seismic event that it is going to take us somewhere else. And so I think we are in a different place culturally, psychologically, politically, that we are still in the early stages collectively of mapping, right? So I create this framework around doubles and doppelgangers and a mirror world and a shadowlands that we are not wanting to look at, you know, the sort of collective subconscious. And I hear those framings being used, and it comes back to me from readers and writers. I mean, that's the thing that's been most fun about doppelganger is I would say one of the things that is a little bit different and special about the experience of having published this book is that immediately it started inspiring some amazing writing in a way that's different than my other books. Like, I'm giving you examples of people coming to me and going, oh, I'm seeing an example of it here. But with doppelganger, like, some of my favorite writers just went off and wrote essays of like where they see the mirror world and what they've experienced. And a writer named Naomi will write her experience of being a Naomi, or like twins will write about their experience of living in the world as a double. And I just love that because I know that as a writer, we all know that we inspire each other all the time, and that there's nothing more inspiring than reading good writing. And then you're like, oh, maybe I could do that. Or if it's too good, then it's like actually just discouraging. Like whenever I read James Baldwin, I'm like, I don't know why I ever write. He's already thought and written everything that I might say. But sometimes you read writers who aren't that good, and but they're good. And you're like, okay, I'm ready.
Inspiring. Yeah. Towards the end of Doppelganger, there's a passage where you are grappling with the same sort of looming hopelessness that I think a lot of people feel at the moment about the state of the world, the climate, the political situations, the wars, the, you know, culture wars, all of this stuff. And you're sort of trying to find through that section a kind of way forward and a way to find hope. Do you think that working as a writer drains your hope or gives you hope?
I mean, I wouldn't put it in terms of hope or lack of hope. I mean, I think reporting often gives me hope in the sense of going out into the physical world and meeting people
doing cool stuff, yeah.
You know, and courageous things and that sort of the energy that we give one another. And I often write about social movements, you know, and have been swept up in them, and they give me oxygen and energy and hope. With this book, I would say I started to write it in a period of deep vertigo. My doppelganger problems, the fact that people thought I was someone else and someone else was me, was just a kind of a metaphor for a much broader vertigo of what is this world? Where are we? Who are we? Where is this going? And I definitely, you know, this is something else Harriet said. She said, you know, you wrote yourself back into yourself, like you found, like, and so I wouldn't say that I found my hope, but I would say that I refound a sense of orientation and confidence. And that's why I use, you know, the frame of map making to understand what it is that I'm doing is that, and I do work in the geography department at my university. So I'm always telling them I'm not a real geographer. And they're like, you're a human geographer. I'm like, I don't know what that means, but okay, if you say so. but, you know, I think I think that map making is inherently collective work. And this is a very personal first draft of a map of the wildness of now. And the fun part of putting it into the world is being part of this process where other writers who I admire are like, you missed a whole entire mountain range over there. What about this path that we could maybe use over here? And, you know, having that, because writing is collective inherently, it's all the writers that you've read and all the people that you've met informing what you write. And then other writers, if you're lucky, grab it and add. And so it's profoundly orienting is the way I would put it. And I quote John Berger in the book of, you know, when he read The Shock Doctrine, he wrote a blurb for it saying that it gave him a sense of calm, which is an interesting thing to say about a book that is about torture and coup d'etats. But, you know, the fact that he knew, because, you know, in his life, he had seen much of this and he had lost people to it. And he had been a witness to the history that I was writing about, that just having the sort of structure and the order that is the result of the labor of research and organizing research and writing and rewriting made him feel calm. Yeah. And when we're in a state of calm, we're able to be more effective and maybe earn some hope, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense to me, yeah. Is there anything that you find particularly challenging as a writer?
Reading my own handwriting.
The solution is in your own hands there.
It's chronic. I can't fix it. And then finding my way out of the thicket of these Word documents that I create that don't have any order.
So we might call that organizing the material. Is that a bit of a headache?
Organizing the chaos that I create. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I've never found a program like one of these sort of sourcing programs, computer programs that help me keep track of sources in an easy way. I know everybody has their favorites, but I find that frustrating.
Yeah. Mm. Have there been, you mentioned a couple earlier, I think, actually, but have there been any, it might have been a piece of advice or it might have just been a kind of moment of clarity in your own work which really improved your writing, where you've understood that there's a better way of doing something?
I mean, I'll go back further and I'll quote my father, who's a medical researcher, and he was responding to an article that I wrote when I was in university that caused an uproar. It was about Palestine, of all things.
Wow.
And he said, if you go out on a limb don't saw it off.
So what does that mean?
Do your research.
Right.
Just make sure you're on solid ground. If you know what, if you're just reiterating received wisdom and status quo and centrist opinion, you can be really sloppy. Honestly, nobody cares. They're not going to try to catch you out if you're not taking a risky position. But if you're going to actually try to challenge the status quo and have a position that is, you know, another, I don't know if it's advice or just a sort of a reverse pep talk, but when I wrote No Logo and I came under a lot of attack in the right-wing press, an older activist named Maud Barlow in Canada, she writes about water, water privatization and water rights, said to me, "Naomi, serious people have serious enemies." And it sort of depersonalized it. This is why I'm like, was that a pep talk? Was it a scold? What was she saying? She was kind of like, get over yourself. Like, of course you're being attacked. You're taking on power. So if you're like, expect a response. Right. Don't be silly. Don't think that you're not going to get one. Don't get your feelings hurt, because it's actually not about you. So if you are going to challenge power, the need to be rigorous in your research and rigorous in not making stupid errors, it is much greater than if you're not challenging power.
Yeah.
So don't saw it off if you go out on a limb.
That's brilliant advice. When you think about your writing life specifically up to this point, what do you feel proudest of?
I think I'm proudest of the moments when I hear from activists that my work has been useful to their organizing. It's the kind of words meets action. When I wrote This Changes Everything, which was really about the need for an intersectional climate movement, I met some young climate activists, and one of them came up to me and said, "We're doing the book."
That's brilliant.
That was definitely my proudest moment. We're doing the book.
A massive thank you to Naomi Klein. I really loved that conversation. I'm going to link to some of her books in the show notes. I would recommend Doppelganger in particular. I just learned so much from reading it. If you enjoyed the interview, please subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, and maybe rate and review it. I've got a brilliant season ahead with novelists, screenwriters, and even a cartoonist. I think a lot of people have probably forgotten that this podcast exists because it's been so long since the last season. So it would also be wonderful if you want to tell a friend about it or post about it on social media. As the season goes on, I'll also be revealing a bit more about my first book, the In Writing book, which comes out in the UK on the 7th of November. And if you like this podcast, I think there's a high chance that you're going to enjoy the book. It's a different but related thing. It uses dozens of the interviews that I've done with writers over the years, including some very juicy, exclusive new ones that are just for the book, to pull together some common themes. So I've concentrated it on the kinds of things that writers grapple with and that are difficult day to day, from trying to avoid distraction, to generating ideas, to dealing with rejections. And it's organised so that if you're a writer yourself and you're struggling with something, you can look it up in the index. You can look up anxiety or structure or editing, and you can find out how very successful professional writers feel about that thing and what they've learned about how to deal with it. It's a very comforting, confidence building book that I hope will make writers feel less alone, and it certainly made me feel less alone on the days when I was struggling to write the book. It's also really about a lot of life stuff, you know, even if you're not a writer, I think you'll find something useful in there about how we find the courage to put ourselves out there and take risks in life, how we follow our instincts about what's important and meaningful to us, and how we stay resilient but still open in the face of criticism or things going wrong and pick ourselves up again and keep trying. I'm so excited to share it with listeners of this podcast. I'm probably more excited about you reading it than I am about anyone else reading it, because this is where the idea started and I can't wait to hear what resonates with you. If you want to pre-order a copy, I'm going to put a link in the show notes as well. And a reminder before we go that if you want to take your writing to the next level, you can start today with Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. See you next week when I have a wonderful novelist as my guest. Bye for now.